their branches. Chip apprehended it all in a heartbeat. The continent, his homeland. Scattered around the living room were nests of opened presents and little leavings of spent ribbon, wrapping paper fragments, labels. At the foot of the fireside chair that Alfred always claimed for himself, Denise was kneeling by the largest nest of presents.
"Denise, look who's here," Enid said.
As if out of obligation, with downcast eyes, Denise rose and crossed the room. But when she'd put her arms around Chip, and he'd squeezed her in return, her height, as always, surprised him. She wouldn't let go. She clung to him, kissed his neck, fastened her eyes on him, and thanked him. Gary came over and embraced Chip awkwardly, his face averted.
"Didn't think you were going to make it," he said.
"Neither did I," Chip said.
"Well,"
Alfred said again, gazing at him in wonder.
"Gary has to leave at 11, Enid said, "but we can all have breakfast together. You get cleaned up and Denise and I will start breakfast." "Oh, this is just what I wanted," she said, hurrying to the kitchen. "This is the best Christmas present I've ever had."
Gary turned to Chip with his "I'm a jerk" face.
"There you go," he said. "Best Christmas present she's ever had."
"I think she means having all five of us together," Denise said.
"Well, she'd better enjoy it in a hurry," Gary said, "because she owes me a discussion, and I'm expecting payment." Chip, detached from his own body, trailed after it and wondered what it was going to do. He removed an aluminum stool from the downstairs bathroom shower. The blast of water was strong and hot. His impressions were fresh in a way that he would either remember all his life or instantly forget. A brain could absorb only so many impressions before it lost the ability to decode them, to put them in coherent shape and order. His nearly sleepless night on a patch of airport carpeting, for example, was still very much with him and begging to be processed. And now, here was a hot shower on Christmas morning. Here were the familiar tan tiles of the stall. The tiles, like every other physical constituent of the house, were suffused with the fact of their ownership by Enid and Alfred, saturated with an aura of belonging to this family. The house felt more like a body, softer, more mortal and organic, than like a building. Denise's shampoo had the pleasing, subtle sense of late-model Western capitalism. In the seconds it took Chip to lather his hair, he forgot where he was. Forgot the continent. Forgot the year. Forgot the time of day. Forgot the circumstances. His brain in the shower was piscine or amphibian, registering impressions, reacting to the moment. He wasn't far from terror. At the same time, he felt okay. He was hungry for breakfast, and thirsty, in particular, for coffee. With a towel around his waist, he stopped in the living room, where Alfred leaped to his feet. The sight of Alfred's suddenly aged face, its disintegration in progress, its rednesses and asymmetries, cut Chip like a bullwhip.
"Well," Alfred said, "that was quick."
"Can I borrow some clothes of yours?"
"I will leave that to your judgment."
Upstairs in his father's closet, the ancient shaving kits, shoehorns, electric razors, shoe trees, and tie rack were all in their accustomed places. They'd been on duty here each hour of the 1,500 days since Chip had last been in this house. For a moment he was angry, how could he not be, that his parents had never moved anywhere, had simply stayed here, waiting. He took underwear, socks, wool slacks, a white shirt, and a gray cardigan to the room that he'd shared with Gary in the years between Denise's arrival in the family and Gary's departure for college. Gary had an overnight bag open on his twin bed and was packing it.
"I don't know if you noticed," he said, "but Dad's in bad shape."
"No, I noticed." Gary put a small box on Chip's dresser. It was a box of ammunition, 20-gauge shotgun shells.
"He had these out with the gun in the workshop," Gary said. "I went down there this morning, and I thought, better safe than sorry."
Chip looked at the box and spoke instinctively. "Isn't that kind of Dad's own decision?"
That's what I was thinking yesterday, Gary said. But if he wants to do it, he's got other options. It's supposed to be down near zero tonight. He can go outside with a bottle of whiskey. I don't want Mom to find him with his head blown off.
Chip didn't know what to say. He silently dressed in the old man's clothes. The shirt and pants were marvelously clean and fit him better than he would have guessed. He was surprised when he put the cardigan on that his hands did not begin to shake, surprised to see such a young face in the mirror.
"So, what have you been doing with yourself?" Gary said.
"I've been helping a Lithuanian friend of mine defraud Western investors."
"Jesus, Chip, you don't want to be doing that!"
Everything else in the world might be strange, but Gary's condescension galled Chip exactly as it always had. "From a strictly moral viewpoint," Chip said, "I have more sympathy for Lithuania than I do for American investors."
"You want to be a Bolshevik?" Gary said, zipping up his bag. "Fine, be a Bolshevik. Just don't call me when you get arrested."
"It would never occur to me to call you," Chip said.
"Are you fellows about ready for breakfast?" Enid sang from halfway up the stairs.
A holiday linen tablecloth was on the dining table. In the center was an arrangement of pine cones, white holly and green holly, red candles and silver bells. Denise was bringing food out, Texan grapefruit, scrambled eggs, bacon, and a stolen in breads that she'd baked. Snow cover boosted the strong prairie light. Per custom, Gary sat alone on one side of the table. On the other side, Denise sat by Enid and Chip by Alfred.
"Merry, merry, merry Christmas," Enid said, looking each of her children in the eye in turn.
Alfred, head down, was already eating.
Gary also began to eat, rapidly, with a glance at his watch.
Chip didn't remember the coffee being so drinkable in these parts. Denise asked him how he'd gotten home. He told her the story, omitting only the armed robbery. Enid, with a scowl of judgment, was following every move of Gary's.
"Slow down," she said. "You don't have to leave until 11.
"Actually," Gary said, "I said 10:45. It's past 10:30, and we have some things to discuss."
"We're finally all together," Enid said. "Let's just relax and enjoy it."
Gary set his fork down. "I've been here since Monday, Mother, waiting for us all to be together. Denise has been here since Tuesday morning. It's not my fault if Chip was too busy defrauding American investors to get here on time."
"I just explained why I was late," Chip said, "if you were listening."
"Well, maybe you should have left a little earlier."
"What does he mean, defrauding?" Enid said. "I thought you were doing computer work."
"I'll explain it to you later, Mom."
"No," Gary said. "Explain it to her now."
"Gary," Denise said.
"No, sorry," Gary said, throwing down his napkin like a gauntlet. "I've had it with this family. I'm done waiting. I want some answers now."
"I was doing computer work," Chip said, "but Gary's right. Strictly speaking, the intent was to defraud American investors."
"I don't approve of that at all," Enid said.
"I know you don't," Chip said, "although it's a little more complicated than you might."
"What is so complicated about obeying the law?"
"Gary, for God's sake," Denise said with a sigh, "it's Christmas."
"And you're a thief," Gary said, wheeling on her.
"What?"
"You know what I'm talking about. You sneaked into somebody's room, and you took a thing that didn't belong."
"Excuse me," Denise said hotly. "I restored a thing that was stolen from its rightful—"
"Bullshit, bullshit, bullshit!"
"Oh, I'm not sitting here for this," Enid wailed. "Not on Christmas morning."
"No, Mother, sorry. You're not going anywhere," Gary said. "We're going to sit here and have our little talk right now."
Alfred gave Chip a complicit smile and gestured at the others.
"You see what I have to put up with?"
Chip arranged his face in a facsimile of comprehension and agreement.
"Chip, how long are you here for?"
Gary said. 3 days.
"And Denise, you're leaving on—"
"Sunday, Gary, I'm leaving on Sunday."
"So what's going to happen on Monday, Mom? How are you going to make this house work on Monday?"
"I'll think about that when Monday comes." Alfred, still smiling, asked Chip what Gary was talking about.
"I don't know, Dad."
"You really think you're going to go to Philadelphia?" Gary said. "You think Correctol's going to fix all this?"
"No, Gary, I don't," Enid said.
Gary didn't seem to hear her answer.
"Dad, here, do me a favor," he said. "Put your right hand on your left shoulder."
"Gary, stop it," Denise said.
Alfred leaned close to Chip and spoke confidentially.
"What's he asking?"
"He wants you to put your right hand on your left shoulder."
"That's a lot of nonsense."
"Dad," Gary said, "come on, right hand, left shoulder."
"Stop it," Denise said.
"Let's go, Dad. Right hand, left shoulder. Can you do that? You want to show us how you follow simple instructions? Come on. Right hand, left shoulder."
Alfred shook his head. "One bedroom and a kitchen is all we need."
"Al, I don't want one bedroom and a kitchen," Enid said. The old man pushed his chair away from the table and turned once more to Chip. He said,
"You can see it's not without its difficulties."
As he stood up, his leg buckled, and he pitched to the floor, dragging his plate and placemat and coffee cup and saucer along with him. The crash might have been the last bar of a symphony. He lay on his side amid the ruins like a wounded gladiator, a fallen horse. Chip knelt down and helped him into a sitting position while Denise hurried to the kitchen. "It's 11:15, Gary said, as if nothing unusual had happened. "Before I leave, here's a summary. Dad is demented and incontinent. Mom can't have him in this house without a lot of help, which she says she doesn't want even if she could afford it. Correctol is obviously not an option, and so what I want to know is what you're going to do. Now, Mother. I want to know now." Alfred rested his shaking hands on Chip's shoulders and gazed in wonder at the room's furnishings. Despite his agitation, he was smiling.
"My question," he said, "is who owns this house? Who takes care of all of this?"
"You own it, Dad." Alfred shook his head as if this didn't square with the facts as he understood them. Gary was demanding an answer.
"I guess we'll have to try the drug holiday," Enid said.
"Fine, try that," Gary said. "Put him in the hospital, see if they ever let him out. And while you're at it, you might take a drug holiday yourself."
"Gary, she got rid of it,"
Denise said from the floor where she'd knelt with a sponge. "She put it in the disposal, so just lay off."
"Well, I hope you learned your lesson there, Mother."
Chip, in the old man's clothes, wasn't able to follow this conversation. His father's hands were heavy on his shoulders. For the second time in an hour, somebody was clinging to him, as if he were a person of substance, as if there was something to him. In fact, there was so little to him that he couldn't even say whether his sister and his father were mistaken about him. He felt as if his consciousness had been shorn of all identifying marks and transplanted, metempsychotically, into the body of a steady son, a trustworthy brother. Gary had dropped into a crouch beside Alfred. "Dad," he said, "I'm sorry it had to end this way. I love you, and I'll see you again soon."
"Well, you're... well, you're..."
Alfred replied. He lowered his head and looked around with rank paranoia. "And you, my feckless sibling," Gary spread his fingers, claw-like, on top of Chip's head in what he apparently meant as a gesture of affection. "I'm counting on you to help out here."
"I'll do my best," Chip said, with less irony than he'd aimed for.
Gary stood up. "I'm sorry I ruined your breakfast, Mom, but I, for one, feel better for having gotten this off my chest."
"Why, you couldn't have waited till after the holiday," Enid muttered.
Gary kissed her cheek. "Call Hedgepeth tomorrow morning, then call me and tell me what the plan is. I'm going to monitor this closely." It seemed unbelievable to Chip that Gary could simply walk out of the house with Alfred on the floor and Enid's Christmas breakfast in ruins. But Gary was in his most rational mode. His words had a formal hollowness. His eyes were evasive as he put on his coat and gathered up his bag and Enid's bag of gifts for Philadelphia, because he was afraid. Chip could see it clearly now, behind the cold front of Gary's wordless departure. His brother was afraid. As soon as the front door had closed, Alfred made his way to the bathroom.
"Let's all be happy," Denise said, "that Gary got that off his chest and feels so much better now." "No, he's right," Enid said, her eyes resting bleakly on the holly centerpiece. "Something has to change." After breakfast, the hours passed in the sickishness, the invalid waiting, of a major holiday. Chip, in his exhaustion, had trouble staying warm, but his face was flushed with the heat from the kitchen and the smell of baking turkey that blanketed the house. Whenever he entered his father's field of vision, a smile of recognition and pleasure spread over Alfred's face. This recognition might have had the character of mistaken identity if it hadn't been accompanied by Alfred's exclamation of Chip's name. Chip seemed beloved to the old man. He'd been arguing with Alfred and deploring Alfred and feeling the sting of Alfred's disapproval for most of his life. And his personal failures and his political views were, if anything, more extreme than ever now, and yet it was Gary who was fighting with the old man. It was Chip who brightened the old man's face. At dinner, he took the trouble to describe in some detail his activities in Lithuania. He might as well have been reciting the tax code in a monotone. Denise, normally a paragon of listening, was absorbed in helping Alfred with his food, and Enid had eyes only for her husband's deficiencies. She flinched or sighed or shook her head at every spilled bite, every non sequitur. Alfred was quite visibly making her life a hell now. "I'm the least unhappy person at this table," Chip thought. He helped Denise wash the dishes while Enid spoke to her grandsons on the telephone, and Alfred went to bed. "How long has Dad been like this?" he asked Denise. "Like this? Just since yesterday, but he wasn't great before that." Chip put on a heavy coat of Alfred's and took a cigarette outside. The cold was deeper than any he'd experienced in Vilnius. Wind rattled the thick brown leaves still clinging to the oaks, those most conservative of trees. Snow squeaked beneath his feet. "Near zero tonight," Gary had said. "He can go outside with a bottle of whiskey." Chip wanted to pursue the important question of suicide while he had a cigarette to enhance his mental performance, but his bronchi and nasal passages were so traumatized by cold that the trauma of smoke barely registered, and the ache in his fingers and ears, the damned rivets, was fast becoming unbearable. He gave up and hurried inside, just as Denise was leaving. "Where are you going?" Chip asked. "I'll be back." Enid, by the fire in the living room, was gnawing at her lip with naked desolation. "You haven't opened your presents," she said. "Maybe in the morning," Chip said. "I'm sure I didn't get you anything you're like." "It's nice you got me anything." Enid shook her head. "This wasn't the Christmas I'd hoped for. Suddenly Dad can't do a thing. Not one single thing."
"Let's give him a drug holiday and see if that helps."
Enid might have been reading bad prognoses in the fire.
"Will you stay for a week and help me take him to the hospital?"
Chip's hand went to the rivet in his earlobe as to a talisman. He felt like a child out of Grimm, lured into the enchanted house by the warmth and the food, and now the witch was going to lock him in a cage, fatten him up, and eat him. He repeated the charm he'd invoked at the front door. "I can only stay 3 days," he said. "I've got to start working right away. I owe Denise some money that I need to pay her back."
"Just a week," the witch said. "Just a week until we see how things go in the hospital."
"I don't think so, Mom. I've got to go back."
Enid's bleakness deepened, but she didn't seem surprised by his refusal.
"I guess this is my responsibility, then," she said. "I guess I always knew it would be."
She retired to the den, and Chip put more logs on the fire. Cold drafts were finding ways through the windows, faintly stirring the open curtains. The furnace was running almost constantly. The world was colder and emptier than Chip had realized. The adults had gone away. Toward 11, Denise came inside, reeking of cigarettes and looking two-thirds frozen. She waved to Chip and tried to go straight upstairs, but he insisted that she sit by the fire. She knelt and bowed her head, sniffling steadily, and put her hands out toward the embers. She kept her eyes on the fire as if to ensure that she not look at him. She blew her nose on a wet shred of Kleenex.
"Where'd you go?" he said.
"Just on a walk."
"Long walk?"
"Yeah."
"You sent me some emails that I deleted before I really read them."
"Oh."
"So, what's going on?" he said.
She shook her head. "Just everything."
"I had almost $30,000 in cash on Monday. I was going to give you $24,000 of it. But then we got robbed by uniformed men in ski masks, implausible as that may sound."
"I want to forgive that debt," Denise said.
Chip's hand went to the rivet again. "I'm going to start paying you a minimum of $400 a month until the principal and interest are paid off. It's my top priority, absolute highest priority."
His sister turned and raised her face to him. Her eyes were bloodshot, her forehead as red as a newborn's. "I said, I forgive the debt."
"You owe me nothing."
"Appreciate it," he said quickly, looking away, "but I'm going to pay you anyway."
"No," she said, "I'm not going to take your money. I forgive the debt. Do you know what forgive means?"
In her peculiar mood, with her unexpected words, she was making Chip anxious. He pulled on the rivet and said, "Denise, come on, please. At least show me the respect of letting me pay you back. I realize I've been a shit, but I don't want to be a shit all my life."
"I want to forgive that debt," she said.
"Really, come on." Chip smiled desperately. "You've got to let me pay you."
"Can you stand to be forgiven?"
"No," he said. "Basically, no, I can't. It's better all around if I pay you." Still kneeling, Denise bent over and tucked in her arms and made herself into an olive, an egg, an onion. From within this bald form came a low voice. "Do you understand what a huge favor you'd be doing me if you would let me forgive the debt? Do you understand that it's hard for me to ask this favor? Do you understand that coming here for Christmas is the only other favor I've ever asked you? Do you understand that I'm not trying to insult you? Do you understand that I never doubted that you wanted to pay me back, and I know I'm asking you to do something very hard? Do you understand that I wouldn't ask you to do something so hard if I didn't really, really, really need it?" Chip looked at the trembling, bald human form at his feet.
"Tell me what's wrong."
"I'm having trouble on numerous fronts," she said.
"This is a bad time to talk about the money, then. Let's forget it for a while. I want to hear what's bothering you."
Still balled up, Denise shook her head emphatically once. "I need you to say yes. Here, now. Say yes, thank you."
Chip made a gesture of utter bafflement. It was near midnight, and his father had begun to thump around upstairs, and his sister was curled up like an egg and begging him to accept relief from the principal torment of his life.
"Let's talk about it tomorrow," he said.
"Would it help if I asked you for something else?"
"Tomorrow, okay?"
"Mom wants somebody here next week," Denise said. "You could stay a week and help her."
"That would be a huge relief for me. I'm going to die if I stay past Sunday. I will literally cease to exist."
Chip was breathing hard. The door of the cage was closing on him fast. The sensation he'd had in the men's room at the Vilnius airport, the feeling that his debt to Denise, far from being a burden, was his last defense, returned to him in the form of dread at the prospect of its being forgiven. He'd lived with the affliction of this debt until it had assumed the character of a neuroblastoma so intricately implicated in his cerebral architecture that he doubted he could survive its removal. He wondered if the last flights east had left the airport, or whether he might still escape tonight.
"How about we split the debt in half?" he said. "So I only owe you 10. How about we both stay here till Wednesday?"
Nope.
If I said yes, he said, would you stop being so weird and lighten up a little?
First say yes.
Alfred was calling Chip's name from upstairs. He was saying, Chip, can you help me? He calls your name even when you're not here, Denise said. The windows shook in the wind. When had it happened that his parents had become the children who went to bed early and called down for help from the top of the stairs? When had this happened?
Chip, Alfred called, I don't understand this blanket. Can you help me?
The house shook, and the storms rattled, and the draft from the window nearest Chip intensified. And in a gust of memory, he remembered the curtains. He remembered when he'd left St. Jude for college. He remembered packing the hand-carved Austrian chessmen that his parents had given him for his high school graduation, and the 6-volume Sandburg biography of Lincoln that they'd given him for his 18th birthday, and his new navy blue blazer from Brooks Brothers.
It makes you look like a handsome young doctor, Enid hinted.
And great stacks of white T-shirts, and white jockey underpants, and white long johns, and a 5th-grade school picture of Denise in a lucite frame, and the very same Hudson Bay blanket that Alfred had taken as a freshman to the University of Kansas 4 decades earlier, and a pair of leather-clad wool mittens that likewise dated from Alfred's deep Kansan past, and a set of heavy-duty thermal curtains that Alfred had bought for him at Sears.
Reading Chip's college orientation materials, Alfred had been struck by the sentence, New England winters can be very cold. The curtains he'd bought at Sears were of a plasticized brown and pink fabric with a backing of foam rubber. They were heavy and bulky and stiff.
You'll appreciate these on a cold night, he told Chip. You'll be surprised how much they cut down drafts.
But Chip's freshman roommate was a prep school product named Roan McCorkle, who would soon be leaving thumbprints in what appeared to be Vaseline on the 5th-grade photo of Denise. Roan laughed at the curtains, and Chip laughed too. He put them back in the box, and stowed the box in the basement of the dorm, and let it gather mold there for the next 4 years. He had nothing against the curtains personally. They were simply curtains, and they wanted no more than what any curtains wanted, to hang well, to exclude light to the best of their ability, to be neither too small nor too large for the window that it was their task in life to cover. To be pulled this way in the evening and that way in the morning, to stir in the breezes that came before rain on a summer night, to be much used and little noticed. There were numberless hospitals and retirement homes and budget motels, not just in the Midwest but in the East as well, where these particular brown rubber-backed curtains could have had a long and useful life. It wasn't their fault that they didn't belong in a dorm room. They'd betrayed no urge to rise above their station. Their material and patterning contained not a hint of unseemly ambition. They were what they were. If anything, when he finally dug them out on the eve of graduation, their virginal pinkish folds turned out to be rather less plasticized and homely and Sears-like than he remembered. They were nowhere near as shameful as he'd thought.
I don't understand. "Stand these blankets," Alfred said.
"All right," Chip told Denise as he started up the stairs. "If it makes you feel better, I won't pay you back."
The question was, how to get out of this prison? The big black lady, the mean one, the bastard, was the one he had to keep an eye on. She intended to make his life a hell. She stood at the far end of the prison yard, throwing him significant glances to remind him that she hadn't forgotten him. She was still in hot pursuit of her vendetta. She was a lazy black bastard, and he said so at a shout. He cursed the bastards, black and white, all around him. God-damned sneaky bastards with their pin-headed regulations. EPA bureaucrats, OSHA functionaries, insolent so-and-sos. They were keeping their distance now, sure, because they knew he was onto them. but just let him nod off. For 1 minute, just let him let his guard down and watch what they would do to him. They could hardly wait to tell him he was nothing. They could hardly wait to show their disrespect. That fat black bastard, that nasty black bitch over there, held his eye and nodded across the white heads of the other prisoners. "I'm going to get you." That's what her nod said to him. And nobody else could see what she was doing to him. All the rest were timid, useless strangers talking nonsense. He'd said hello to one of the fellows, asked him a simple question. The fellow didn't even understand English. It ought to have been simple enough, ask a simple question, get a simple answer, but evidently not. He was on his own now. He was by himself in a corner. And the bastards were out to get him. He didn't understand where Chip was. Chip was an intellectual and had ways of talking sense to these people. Chip had done a good job yesterday, better than he could have done himself. Asked a simple question, got a simple answer, and then explained it in a way that a man could understand. But there was no sign of Chip now. Inmates semaphoring one another, waving their arms like traffic cops. Just try giving a simple order to these people, just try it. They pretended you didn't exist. That fat bastard black woman had them all scared witless. If she figured out that the prisoners were on his side, if she found out they'd aided him in any way, she'd make them pay. Oh, she had that look. She had that "I'm gonna make you hurt" look. And he, at this point in his life, he'd had just about enough of this insolent black type of woman, but what could you do? It was a prison. It was a public institution. They'd throw anybody in here. White-haired women semaphoring. Hairless fairies touching toes. But why him, for God's sake? Why him? It made him weep to be thrown into a place like this. It was hell to get old, even without being persecuted by that waddling black so-and-so. And here she came again.
"Alfred?"
Sassy. Insolent. "You gonna let me stretch your legs now?" "You're a goddamn bastard," he told her.
"I is what I is, Alfred, but I know who my parents are. Now why don't you put your hands down nice and easy and let me stretch your legs and help you feel better?"
He lunged as she came at him, but his belt had got stuck in the chair. In the chair, somehow, in the chair, got stuck in the chair, and he couldn't move.
"You keep that up, Alfred," the mean one said, "and we're going to have to take you back to your room."
"Bastard, bastard, bastard." She pulled an insolent face and went away. But he knew that she'd be back. They always came back. His only hope was to get his belt free of the chair somehow. Get himself free, make a dash, put an end to it. Bad design to build a prison yard this many stories up. A man could see clear to Illinois. Big window right there. Bad design if they meant to house prisoners here. From the look of the glass, it was thermal pane, 2 layers. If he hit it with his head and pitched forward, he could make it. But first, he had to get the goddamned belt free. He struggled with its smooth nylon breadth in the same way, over and over. There was a time when he'd encountered obstacles philosophically, but that time was past. His fingers were as weak as grass when he tried to work them under the belt so he could pull on it. They bent like soft bananas. Trying to work them under the belt was so obviously and utterly hopeless. The belt had such overwhelming advantages of toughness and tightness that his efforts soon became merely a pageant of spite and rage and incapacity. He caught his fingernails on the belt and then flung his arms apart, letting his hands bang into the arms of his captivating chair and painfully ricochet this way and that way because he was so goddamned angry. "Dad, Dad, Dad, whoa, calm down," the voice said. "Get that bastard! Get that bastard!
Dad, whoa! It's me! It's Chip!"
Indeed, the voice was familiar.
He looked up at Chip carefully to make sure the speaker really was his middle child, because the bastards would try to take advantage of you any way they could. Indeed, if the speaker had been anybody in the world but Chip, it wouldn't have paid to trust him. Too risky. But there was something in Chipper that the bastards couldn't fake. You looked at Chipper, and you knew he'd never lie to you. There was a sweetness to Chipper that nobody else could counterfeit. As his identification of Chipper deepened toward certainty, his breathing leveled out, and something like a smile pushed through the other warring forces in his face.
Well, he said finally.
Chip pulled another chair over and gave him a cup of ice water for which he realized he was thirsty. He took a long pull on the straw and gave the water back to Chip.
Where's your mother?
Chip set the cup on the floor. She woke up with a cold. I told her to stay in bed.
Where's she living now?
She's at home, exactly where she was 2 days ago. Chip had already explained to him why he had to be here, and the explanation had made sense as long as he could see Chip's face and hear his voice. But as soon as Chip was gone, the explanation fell apart. The big black bastard was circling the two of them with her evil eye. This is a physical therapy room, Chip said. We're on the 8th floor of St. Luke's. Mom had her foot operation here, if you remember that.
That woman is a bastard, he said, pointing.
No, she's a physical therapist, Chip said, and she's been trying to help you.
No, look at her. Do you see the way she's... Do you see it?
She's a physical therapist, eh?
The what? She's a...
On the one hand, he trusted the intelligence and assurance of his intellectual son. On the other hand, the black bastard was giving him the eye to warn him of the harm she intended to do him at her earliest opportunity. There was a grand malevolence to her manner, plain as day. He couldn't begin to reconcile this contradiction, his belief that Chip was absolutely right, and his conviction that the bastard absolutely wasn't any physicist. The contradiction opened into a bottomless chasm. He stared into its depths, his mouth hanging open. A warm thing was crawling down his chin. And now some bastard's hand was reaching for him. He tried to slug the bastard and realized in the nick of time that the hand belonged to Chip. Easy, Dad. I'm just wiping your chin.
Ah, God.
Do you want to sit here a little, or do you want to go back to your room?
I leave it to your discretion.
This handy phrase came to him all ready to be spoken, neat as you please. Let's go back, then. Chip reached behind the chair and made adjustments. Evidently the chair had casters and levers of enormous complexity.
See if you can get my belt unhooked, he said.
We'll go back to the room, and then you can walk around. Chip wheeled him out of the yard and up the cell block to his cell. He couldn't get over how luxurious the appointments were, like a first-class hotel room, except for the bars on the bed, and the shackles and the radios, the prisoner control equipment. Chip parked him near the window, left the room with a styrofoam pitcher, and returned a few minutes later in the company of a pretty little girl in a white jacket. "Mr. Lambert," she said. She was pretty like Denise, with curly black hair and wire glasses, but smaller. "I'm Dr. Schulman. You may remember we met yesterday."
Well,
he said, smiling wide. He remembered a world where there were girls like this, pretty little girls with bright eyes and smart brows, a world of hope. She placed a hand on his head and bent down as if to kiss him. She scared the hell out of him. He almost hit her. I didn't mean to scare you, she said. I just want to look in your eye. Is that all right with you? He turned to Chip for reassurance, but Chip himself was staring at the girl.
Chip,
he said. Chip took his eyes off her. Yeah, Dad. Well, now that he'd attracted Chip's attention, he had to say something, and what he said was this.
Tell your mother not to worry about the mess down there. I'll take care of all that.
Okay, I'll tell her. The girl's clever fingers and soft face were all around his head. She asked him to make a fist. She pinched him and prodded him. She was talking like the television in somebody else's room. Dad, Chip said.
I didn't hear.
Dr. Schulman wants to know if you'd prefer Alfred or Mr. Lambert. What would you rather she called you? He grinned painfully.
I'm not following.
I think he prefers Mr. Lambert, Chip said. Mr. Lambert, said the little girl, can you tell me where we are? He turned again to Chip, whose expression was expectant but unhelpful. He pointed toward the window.
That's Illinois, in that direction.
he said to his son and to the girl. Both were listening with great interest now, and he felt he should say more.
"There's a window," he said, "which, if you get it open, would be what I want. I couldn't get the belt undone. And then..."
He was failing, and he knew it. The little girl looked down on him kindly. "Can you tell me who our president is?"
He grinned. It was an easy one. "Well," he said, "she's got so much stuff down there, I doubt she'd even notice. We ought to pitch the whole lot of it."
The little girl nodded as if this were a reasonable answer. Then she held up both her hands. She was pretty like Enid, but Enid had a wedding ring. Enid didn't wear glasses. Enid had lately gotten older, and he probably would have recognized Enid, although being far more familiar to him than Chip, she was that much harder to see. "How many fingers am I holding up?" the girl asked him. He considered her fingers. As far as he could tell, the message they were sending was relax. Unclench. Take it easy. With a smile, he let his bladder empty. "Mr. Lambert, how many fingers am I holding up?"
The fingers were there. It was a beautiful thing, the relief of irresponsibility. The less he knew, the happier he was. To know nothing at all would be heaven.
"Dad?"
"I should know that," he said. "Can you believe I'd forget a thing like that?"
The little girl and Chip exchanged a look and then went out into the corridor. He'd enjoyed unclenching, but after a minute or two he felt clammy. He needed to change his clothes now, and he couldn't. He sat in his mess as it chilled.
"Chip,"
he said. The stillness had fallen on the cell block. He couldn't rely on Chip. He was always disappearing. He couldn't rely on anybody but himself. With no plan in his head and no power in his hands, he attempted to loosen the belt so he could take his pants off and dry himself. But the belt was as maddening as ever. 20 times he ran his hands along its length, and 20 times he failed to find a buckle. He was like a person of 2 dimensions seeking freedom in a third. He could search for all eternity and never find the goddamned buckle.
"Chip,"
he called, but not loudly, because the black bastard was lurking out there and she would punish him severely.
"Chip, come and help me."
He would have liked to remove his legs entirely. They were weak and restless and wet and trapped. He kicked a little and rocked in his unrocking chair. His hands were in a tumult. The less he could do about his legs, the more he swung his arms. The bastards had him now. He'd been betrayed. And he began to cry. If only he'd known. If only he'd known, he could have taken steps. He'd had the gun. He'd had the bottomless cold ocean. If only he'd known. He swatted a pitcher of water against the wall, and finally somebody came running.
"Dad, Dad, Dad, what's wrong?"
Alfred looked up at his son and into his eyes. He opened his mouth, but the only word he could produce was, I have made mistakes. I am alone. I am wet. I want to die. I am sorry. I did my best. I love my children. I need your help. I want to die.
I can't be here, he said.
Chip crouched on the floor by the chair. Listen, he said. You have to stay here another week so they can monitor you. We need to find out what's wrong. He shook his head.
No. You have to get me out of here,
"Dad, I'm sorry," Chip said, "but I can't take you home. You have to stay here for another week at least." Oh, how his son tried his patience. By now, Chip should have understood what he was asking for without being told again.
"I'm saying put an end to it,"
he banged on the arms of his captivating chair.
"You have to help me put an end to it."
He looked at the window through which he was ready at last to throw himself. Or give him a gun, give him an axe. Give him anything, but get him out of here. He had to make Chip understand this. Chip covered his shaking hands with his own. "I'll stay with you, Dad," he said. "But I can't do that for you. I can't put an end to it like that. I'm sorry." Like a wife who had died or a house that had burned, the clarity to think and the power to act were still vivid in his memory. Through a window that gave onto the next world, he could still see the clarity and see the power just out of reach beyond the window's thermal panes. He could see the desired outcomes, the drowning at sea, the shotgun blast, the plunge from a height, so near to him still that he refused to believe he'd lost the opportunity to avail himself of their relief. He wept at the injustice of his sentence.
"For God's sake, Chip," he said loudly, because he sensed that this might be his last chance to liberate himself before he lost all contact with that clarity and power, and it was therefore crucial that Chip understand exactly what he wanted. "I'm asking for your help. You've got to get me out of this. You have to put an end to it."
Even red-eyed, even tear-streaked, Chip's face was full of power and clarity. Here was a son whom he could trust to understand him as he understood himself. And so Chip's answer, when it came, was absolute. Chip's answer told him that this was where the story ended. It ended with Chip shaking his head. It ended with him saying, "I can't, Dad. I can't." The corrections. The correction, when it finally came, was not an overnight bursting of a bubble, but a much more gentle letdown. A year-long leakage of value from key financial markets, a contraction too gradual to generate headlines and too predictable to seriously hurt anybody but fools and the working poor. It seemed to Enid that current events in general were more muted or insipid nowadays than they'd been in her youth. She had memories of the 1930s. She'd seen firsthand what could happen to a country when the world economy took its gloves off. She'd helped her mother pass out leftovers to homeless men in the alley behind their rooming house. But disasters of this magnitude no longer seemed to befall the United States. Safety features had been put in place, like the squares of rubber that every modern playground was paved with, to soften impacts. Nevertheless, the markets did collapse, and Enid, who hadn't dreamed that she would ever be glad that Alfred had locked their assets up in annuities and T-bills, weathered the downturn with less anxiety than her high-flying friends. Orphic Midland did, as threatened, terminate her traditional health insurance and force her into an HMO, but her old neighbor, Dean Driblet, with a stroke of a pen, bless his heart, upgraded her and Alfred to DD Care Choice Plus, which allowed her to keep her favorite doctors. She still had major, non-reimbursable monthly nursing home expenses, but by scrimping she was able to pay the bills with Alfred's pension and railroad retirement benefits, and meanwhile her house, which she owned outright, continued to appreciate. The simple truth was that although she wasn't rich, she also wasn't poor. Somehow, this truth had eluded her during the years of her anxiety and uncertainty about Alfred, but as soon as he was out of the house and she'd caught up on her sleep, she saw it clearly. She saw everything more clearly now, her children in particular. When Gary returned to St. Jude with Jonah a few months after the catastrophic Christmas, she had nothing but fun with them.
Gary still wanted her to sell the house, but he could no longer argue that Alfred was going to fall down the stairs and kill himself. And by then, Chip had done many of the jobs, wicker painting, waterproofing, gutter cleaning, crack patching, which, as long as they'd been neglected, had been Gary's other good argument for selling the house. He and Enid did bicker about money, but this was recreational. Gary hounded her for the $4.96 that she still owed him for 6 6-inch bolts, and she countered by asking, "Is that a new watch?" He conceded that, yes, Caroline had given him a new Rolex for Christmas, but more recently he'd taken a nasty little bath on a biotech IPO whose shares he couldn't sell before June 15th, and anyway, there was a principle at stake here, Mother, a principle. But Enid refused, on principle, to give him the $4.96. She enjoyed knowing that she would go to her grave refusing to pay for those 6 bolts. She asked Gary which biotech stock exactly he'd taken the bath on. Gary said, never mind. After Christmas, Denise moved to Brooklyn and went to work at a new restaurant, and in April she sent Enid a plane ticket for her birthday. Enid thanked her and said she couldn't make the trip, she couldn't possibly leave Alfred, it would not be right. Then she went and enjoyed 4 wonderful days in New York City. Denise looked so much happier than she had at Christmas that Enid chose not to care that she still didn't have a man in her life or any discernible desire to get one. Back in St. Jude, Enid was playing bridge at Mary Beth Schumpert's one afternoon when B. Meisner began to vent her Christian disapproval of a famous gay actress. "She's a terrible role model for young people," B. said. "I think if you make an evil choice in your life, the least you can do is not brag about it, especially when they have all these new programs that can help people like that." Enid, who was B.'s partner for that rubber and was already annoyed by B.'s failure to respond to an opening two bid, mildly commented that she didn't think gays could help being gay. "Oh, no, it's definitely a choice," B said. "It's a weakness, and it starts in adolescence. There's no question about that. All the experts agree." "I loved that thriller her girlfriend made with Harrison Ford," Mary Beth Schumpert said. "What was it called?" "I don't believe it's a choice," Enid insisted quietly. "Chip said an interesting thing to me once. He said that with so many people hating gays and disapproving of them, why would anybody choose to be gay if they could help it? I thought that was really an interesting perspective." "Well, no, it's because they want special rights," B said. "It's because they want to have gay pride. That's why so many people don't like them, even apart from the immorality of what they're doing. They can't just make an evil choice. They have to brag about it, too." "I can't remember the last time I saw a really good movie," said Mary Beth. Enid was no champion of alternative lifestyles, and the things she disliked about B. Meisner she disliked for 40 years. She couldn't have said why this particular bridge-table conversation made her decide that she no longer needed to be friends with B. Meisner. Nor could she have said why Gary's materialism and Chip's failures and Denise's childlessness, which had cost her countless late-night hours of fretting and punitive judgment over the years, distressed her so much less once Alfred was out of the house. It made a difference, certainly, that all three of her kids were helping out. Chip, in particular, seemed almost miraculously transformed. After Christmas, he stayed with Enid for 6 weeks, visiting Alfred every day before returning to New York. A month later, he was back in St. Jude, minus his awful earrings. He proposed that he extend his visit to a length that delighted and astonished Enid until it emerged that he'd got himself involved with the chief neurology resident at St. Luke's Hospital. The neurologist, Alison Schulman, was a kinky-haired and rather plain-looking Jewish girl from Chicago. Enid liked her well enough, but she was mystified that a successful young doctor wanted anything to do with her semi-employed son. The mystery deepened in June when Chip announced that he was moving to Chicago to commence an immoral cohabitation with Allison, who had joined a group practice in Skokie. Chip neither confirmed nor denied that he had no real job and no intention of paying his fair share of household expenses. He claimed to be working on a screenplay. He said that his producer in New York had loved his new version and asked for a rewrite. His only gainful employment, however, as far as Enid knew, was part-time substitute teaching. Enid did appreciate that he drove to St. Jude from Chicago once a month and spent several long days with Alfred. She loved having a child of hers back in the Midwest. But when Chip informed her that he was going to be the father of twins with a woman he wasn't even married to, and when he then invited Enid to a wedding at which the bride was 7 months pregnant and the groom's current job consisted of rewriting his screenplay for the fourth or fifth time, and the majority of the guests not only were extremely Jewish but seemed delighted with the happy couple, there was certainly no shortage of material for Enid to find fault with and condemn. And it didn't make her proud of herself, it didn't make her feel good about her nearly 50 years of marriage, to think that if Alfred had been with her at the wedding, she would have found fault and she would have condemned. If she'd been sitting beside Alfred, the crowd bearing down on her would surely have seen the sour look on her face and turned away, would surely not have lifted her and her chair off the ground and carried her around the room while the klezmer music played, and she would surely not have loved it. The sorry fact seemed to be that life without Alfred in the house was better for everyone but Alfred. Hedgepeth and the other doctors, including Alison Schulman, had kept the old man at St. Luke's through January and into February, lustily billing Orphic Midland's soon-to-be former health insurer while they explored every conceivable avenue of treatment, from ECT to Haldol. Alfred was finally discharged with a diagnosis of Parkinsonism, dementia, depression, and neuropathy of the legs and urinary tract. Enid felt morally obliged to offer to care for him at home, but her children, thank God, wouldn't hear of it. Alfred was installed in the Deepmire Home, a long-term care facility adjacent to the country club, and Enid undertook to visit him every day, to keep him well-dressed, and to bring him homemade treats. She was glad, if nothing else, to have his body back. She'd always loved his size, his shape, his smell, and he was much more available now that he was restrained in a jerry chair and unable to formulate coherent objections to being touched. He let himself be kissed and didn't cringe if her lips lingered a little. He didn't flinch if she stroked his hair. His body was what she'd always wanted. It was the rest of him that was the problem. She was unhappy before she went to visit him, unhappy while she sat beside him, and unhappy for hours afterward. He'd entered a phase of deep randomness. Enid might arrive and find him sunk deeply in a funk, his chin on his chest and a cookie-sized drool spot on his pants leg. Or he might be chatting amiably with a stroke victim or a potted plant. He might be unpeeling the invisible piece of fruit that occupied his attention hour after hour. He might be sleeping. Whatever he was doing, though, he wasn't making sense. Somehow Chip and Denise had the patience to sit and converse with him about whatever demented scenario he inhabited, whatever train wreck or incarceration or luxury cruise, but Enid couldn't tolerate the least error. If he mistook her for her mother, she corrected him angrily, "Al, it's me, Enid, your wife of 48 years." If he mistook her for Denise, she used the very same words. She'd felt wrong all her life, and now she had a chance to tell him how wrong he was. Even as she was loosening up and becoming less critical in other areas of life, she remained strictly vigilant at the Deepmire home. She had to come and tell Alfred that he was wrong to dribble ice cream on his clean, freshly pressed pants. He was wrong not to recognize Joe Person when Joe was nice enough to drop in. He was wrong not to look at snapshots of Aaron and Caleb and Jonah. He was wrong not to be excited that Allison had given birth to 2 slightly underweight but healthy baby girls. He was wrong not to be happy or grateful or even remotely lucid when his wife and daughter went to enormous trouble to bring him home for Thanksgiving dinner. He was wrong to say after that dinner, when they returned him to the Deepmire home, "Better not to leave here than to have to come back." He was wrong if he could be so lucid as to produce a sentence like that, not to be lucid at any other time. He was wrong to attempt to hang himself with bedsheets in the night. He was wrong to hurl himself against a window. He was wrong to try to slash his wrist with a dinner fork. Altogether, he was wrong about so many things that, except for her 4 days in New York and her 2 Christmases in Philadelphia and her 3 weeks of recovery from hip surgery, she never failed to visit him. She had to tell him, while she still had time, how wrong he'd been and how right she'd been. How wrong not to love her more. How wrong not to cherish her and have sex at every opportunity. How wrong not to trust her financial instincts. How wrong to have spent so much time at work and so little with the children. How wrong to have been so negative. How wrong to have been so gloomy. How wrong to have run away from life. How wrong to have said no again and again instead of yes. She had to tell him all of this, every single day. Even if he wouldn't listen, she had to tell him. He'd been living at the Diepmeier home for 2 years, when he stopped accepting food. Chip took time away from parenthood and his new teaching job at a private high school and his 8th revision of the screenplay to visit from Chicago and say goodbye. Alfred lasted longer after that than anyone expected. He was a lion to the end. His blood pressure was barely measurable when Denise and Gary flew into town, and still he lived another week. He lay curled up on the bed and barely breathed. He moved for nothing, and responded to nothing except to shake his head emphatically once if Enid tried to put an ice chip in his mouth. The one thing he never forgot was how to refuse. All of her correction had been for naught. He was as stubborn as the day she'd met him. And yet when he was dead, when she'd pressed her lips to his forehead and walked out with Denise and Gary into the warm spring night, she felt that nothing could kill her hope now. Nothing. She was 75. And she was going to make some changes in her life.
The Corrections was written by Jonathan Franzen and read by George Guidel. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.